All right, here we go. It is February 15th of 2014. My name is Henry Turner, and my partner and I, Isaac Wiggins, we will be interviewing David Landrum today. And without further ado, let's go ahead and get going. So, Dave, you're from here in Springfield. Do you want to just kind of tell us briefly about your childhood? Like, just kind of give us the quick rundown up to before you joined the Army?
Sure. So I grew up in Springfield, just on the outskirts of Springfield. We had 10 acres of walnuts and filberts and an orchard. My dad was a construction worker, so he wasn't home during the week, so I ran the farm most of the time. And I graduated from Thurston High School. While I attended Thurston High School, I was took German 3 years of high school and had an opportunity to go on an exchange program. That's one of the reasons that I ended up joining the Army, because I knew I wanted to go back to Germany and had a great time over there, and so it kind of prompted me a little bit down the path.
Okay, and I hate to take a side note this early in the interview, but I
Yeah.
noticed you said filberts.
Yeah.
And that is correct. Hazelnuts is not correct.
Absolutely.
That's an argument that I've had several
Right,
times.
right, right. If you want to charge more, you call them hazelnuts. If you want to be correct, you call them filberts. Yeah.
Okay. I had to highlight
Yeah.
that. Okay, back to the interview. So, you joined the Army right out of high school.
Actually, I went to LCC for 2 terms out there. The expectation, all through my growing up and stuff, was that I was going to go to college. I got to LCC and realized I had no idea what I was doing.
Okay.
It was just an expectation, but I had no goal or real focus. So, the girl I'd been dating my senior year in high school had been talking very heavily with the Army recruiter, so I knew about the language school in Monterey. I knew about a whole bunch of the, at that time they had non-contributory veterans benefits, so you didn't have to put any money
Oh,
in.
wow.
So I went down and talked to the recruiter, said, "Hey, look, I want to go to language school, I want this, I want that," and took the test. And
Okay. So when you joined the Army, how did your family feel about it?
I didn't get a lot of feedback, positive or negative. My dad was, obviously the generation where, guys were supposed to, when you turned 18, 19 years old, you're supposed to go out and figure out your own way in the world. And as long as if I had stayed on the school track and stuff, I could have stayed at home and it would have been fine. But once I decided I wasn't going to go to school anymore, I realized that I needed to figure out some way to move on. And my dad had been in the Navy back, between the Korean War and the Vietnam War, and all his brothers had been Navy, so they, I had a little bit of military background in the family, and so
Okay. So just for a time frame, what year did you join?
I joined in 1981.
Okay. And so you mentioned you wanted to go to the language school in Monterey, and you ended up working as a Russian translator. So can you tell us a little bit about your experience in language school?
So language school was very intense. So you're in class, I don't know, maybe 6 hours a day. All of our instructors, and this was, remember, in 81, this was height of Cold War kind of stuff. And all of our instructors were natives that had gotten out one way or another.
Of Russia?
Yeah.
Okay.
So that was really, the quality of instruction was excellent. And obviously, whenever when you join for a specialty, there's a lot of pressure to perform. The threat was, oh, well, if you fail out of here, we're going to make you a cook. So,
No one wants to be a cook.
no, and no one wants to be a cook. So there was a lot of pressure, but it was a good environment. Being a private in the Army, in some ways, you have so much freedom because your paycheck is essentially discretionary. They give you clothes, they give you food, they give you a place to sleep. So your paycheck, even in Monterey, California, was enough to, have a lot of fun. So I enjoyed it. Most of our class made it through, a few of them didn't here and there, but
Yeah.
yeah.
So, for us civilians, can you tell me, did you go to basic training and then to language school?
Yeah, so I went to basic training in at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. I think I had maybe a week of leave between basic training before I reported to Monterey.
Okay.
So just the timing was a little bit weird. So swung back through Oregon, dropped off, said hi to everybody, and went down to California and signed into language school. The basic Russian course was a year long, so spent a whole year enjoying lovely Monterey, California. So follow-on training, the enlistment to go through Russian, to be a Russian translator, and it varied obviously by language, but for Russian, the minimum enlistment was 4 years because it took so long. I mean, we spent a year in language school, and then we went to Texas, Goodfellow Air Force Base, which is in San Angelo, for I think about 3 months. Then we went to Fort Devens, Massachusetts for another tour. So it was 18, 20 months before we actually got to a duty assignment and were ready to do our jobs. So.
Okay. And does the 18 months that you're being trained, is that part of your 4 years?
Yeah, that's part of your 4 year. That's why, long languages like Chinese or Russian or something, you have to enlist for a longer period of time so they can get you through the training and get some productivity out of you on the other end.
Okay, so jumping back just a little bit to basic training. Every vet has a story about basic training.
I don't know that I have any. I definitely don't have any horror stories about basic training. I always tell people, one of your questions that you had sent me was, what did you find surprising? I had always heard the horror stories about basic training, and although all the old timers always said, well, you never volunteer for anything. So I knew, keep your head down, focus on what they tell you to do and do it, and you'll be fine. I had so much fun in basic training. It was like summer camp, but you got to shoot rifles, you got to throw grenades. I mean, it was a stone cold blast. I don't know that, I didn't expect that. I expected it was gonna be rough. But again, I walked in with the attitude that I was going to, when they said jump, you didn't ask questions, you didn't do anything else, you just went ahead and jumped, and they would tell you when to come back down, and you just didn't cause any problems. So I had a good time.
Okay. Well, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So after you finished your training in the language program, you got deployed to Augsburg in Germany?
Yep.
Okay, so can you tell us about what you did there?
So I actually did what they trained me for, which was I was translating Russian on basically a daily basis. And the battalion I was in was the 502nd Army Security Agency Battalion, ASA Battalion. It was the last ASA battalion in the Army.
And ASA is what?
Army Security Agency.
Okay.
So if you go back and look at kind of the military intelligence version of like Vietnam and stuff, you see ASA a lot. It slowly got phased out over time, and I happened to be lucky in being the last one. So we had people, we had Morse code people, we had language people, we had military intelligence analysts who took all the information that we fed them and figured things out.
Now, how were you getting the language? Was it intercept over the radio? Was it documents that were being brought to you?
It was primarily voice transmission radio, yeah.
So. Okay, so you kind of had a radar out there or something, sort of collection device, running all the traffic, and you, all right, this is what they're saying today.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
And it was, there were certain criteria for things that, if this happened, then it needed to get reported immediately up, just normal, or if it was just routine stuff going on, it wasn't a big deal. So, but that was one of the things. So, somebody would actually be working the position, but then they'd be recording it the whole time in case they missed something or whatever. And then, when you were talking about doing the transcriptions of these, that was the other part of the whole thing. That somebody, I did it for a while. I came out on graveyard shift and would transcribe tapes of all the traffic for the day. So, yeah. It was fun.
And you were there for how long?
I was in Augsburg just under 4 years, I guess.
Okay.
I would have been there through the end of my first enlistment, but then I re-enlisted to stay one more year. I had just gotten married at the time, and so wanted to stabilize my ex-wife. wife at the time, she had a bachelor's degree in German and a minor in Russian, and she had graduated from Oregon State, So she was able to get a job on the German economy. She was translating telex traffic for a German company.
Okay.
So. Yeah.
And what was it like being an American soldier living in Germany at that time?
I will say just from observations, there was widely different experiences. So I mentioned that I had taken German in high school and had the opportunity to actually live in Germany in high school for a brief period of time. So for me, it was spectacular. when I first got there and moved in the barracks and stuff, you know, I was, hey, Landrum, we heard that you speak German. It's like, yeah, I can speak German. It's like, well, if you want to go downtown and translate for us, we'll buy your dinner. So over the course of time, it got to where it's like, hey, Dave, we got a 4-day weekend. We want to go to Austria. We'll cover your expenses. You come and translate.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, I had a great time. I really did. You know, and honestly, it, a lot of the guys didn't really understand. If you made a half-decent attempt to speak a little bit of German, they would 99% of the time just switch to English. Most of them spoke passable English. But, you know, you had to kind of make a little bit of effort in order to get them to do that.
Okay.
So, but, oh, yeah, I love Germany. I had a great time.
And what was it like? You said it was, of course, it was the height of the Cold War.
Right.
What was the atmosphere like in regards to that? Was there tension, things like that?
In retrospect, maybe some. I don't think I fully understood exactly until much later in my career. I will say during the Cold War, and in fact it's the same way currently in Korea. Unfortunately, my perspective now is the reason that there were soldiers in Germany during the Cold War and there's still Americans in South Korea is a trigger point. So if something happens, American soldiers are going to die, which will justify us lighting somebody up. At the time, obviously, I didn't have that kind of perspective. I mean, we had a good time. We got a little bit nervous. Reagan made a series of politically famous gaffes, you know, calling him the evil empire and, you know, talking smack about him when he thought the microphone was off. And it's like, really, really, we're going to start a war over this. You know, we're the ones up here that are going to get shot at. And, you know, you're doing all this. At the end of the day, it all worked. You know, I don't know if it just was a fluke of historical timing or, you know, if Reagan's pressure actually had some effect. Hard to say, but... one interesting thing, so for probably about half the time I was there, I lived off post and rented an apartment, downstairs apartment from this German lady. And she loved American soldiers. And her husband had been killed, and obviously he was in the German army, but he'd been killed on the Russian front. And so she absolutely just hated Russians. And she loved the fact that American soldiers were there, and she was nicest old lady, you know, if she knew that you were supposed to go to that work that day and you didn't, she didn't see you leave, she'd come down and check on, you know, if you were sick, she'd bring you down soup. She was just an absolute sweetie, but, you know, she had a very specific perspective from what happened to her in World War II.
Okay.
About, you know, anti-Russian. It wasn't, I don't know if it was pro-American, but it was definitely anti-Russian, and she knew that we were there to keep the Russians away.
Lesser of two evils.
Exactly. So...
would you say that sentiment was the relatively predominant sentiment amongst the Germans?
No, we had isolated incidents here and there. You know, you'd be at a beer fest, and some of the old men particularly, you know, there were a few anti-American incidents. You know, I wasn't ever involved in anything serious, but, you know, they'd be talking at you and flipping you off and that kind of fun stuff. But, you know, all in all, I think if I had to venture a percentage, I'd say probably 80% of the German population at that time was probably neutral about the whole thing. And then you had the 10% on the very negative side and the 10% on the very positive side. We just didn't interact a lot with them. We brought a lot of money to their economy. You know, we ate off post. We never ate at the mess hall. Mm-hmm. You know, we always ate off post. So we spent a ton of money on the economy and stuff. And
okay, so moving on from there, you from Augsburg, you end up in the 5th Mechanized at Fort Polk.
Yep. Yeah.
So maybe tell us a little about that.
So the big disappointment from that was, so I went from a place where I was actually using my language skills and I was doing everything that the Army had trained me to do to a mechanized infantry unit in Louisiana. So obviously you're not hearing any Russian anymore, and you're spending all your time in the motor pool. As much of a disappointment as it was to get assigned there, I would say that probably, and I only ended up spending a year in division. that was probably one of the key points in my entire career, and probably what kicked me into doing a full 20 years, because we were in the field a lot.
Were you Op 4 for JRTC?
No, this was pre-JRTC.
JRTC is
Joint Readiness Training Center. Okay. I shouldn't say it's pre-JRTC. So it was at Fort Chaffee, Arkansas then.
Okay.
It wasn't that. They hadn't moved it down to Fort Polk. So we still had 5th Infantry Mechanized, which then relocated to Fort Hood when they moved JRTC onto Fort Polk. And I think the 5th is deactivated now. But So 12 months. Each month was divided into what they called P1 and P2 training cycles. P1 training cycle was you trained with your unit. P2 was you trained with brigade or higher. Okay, so small unit, big unit. Well, the brigade that I happened to support was on the opposite cycle. So basically, I could plan on being in the field literally 4 weeks out of every month. And you soldiered hard. You were in the field. I did a month at the National Training Center at Fort Irwin, California and stuff. But I learned so much. I mean, it was cool being a language guy. And, you know, we all kept our hair right, just barely within regs. And no one messed with us too much. But to actually go to Fort Polk, and that's where I really learned to soldier, and you know what it, you know, the other side of the coin, as it were, and the work and effort that goes into it. So,
and you were at Fort Polk in what year?
That would have been 84 to 85. Is that right? 85 to 86. 85 to 86.
And my partner has told me that Fort Polk is not necessarily the most scenic location.
No, it's south of Shreveport, Louisiana.
I experienced hell while I was there out in the swamps.
Yeah, it's a rough place. It's funny, I took one of those little, not to digress too far, one of those little internet things, where should you really live? I came up with Louisiana.
Oh.
I was like, and actually, so... It has its plus and minus. I actually have relatives that live in Shreveport, so I go back periodically and stuff. But yeah, it's hot. There's a lot of bugs. There's not a lot great about Fort Polk. And you're in the middle of nowhere. That was the worst thing about it. I mean, you were very, very isolated.
Vines, thorns, swamps, snakes.
And what was the street with the bar? Third Street?
I only experienced the box.
Okay. Oh, okay. Okay. You were, just rotating in and out. But... Yeah, there was one street. The town is Leesville. It's right outside of it, and it's no more than an eye blink. And there's one little street, and I think it's Third Street, but it's literally bar, 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 and that's where all the soldiers would be. And our battalion, they had standing orders for the staff duty that if anybody called from Third Street, you take the duty truck and you go pick them up. And it was an open bed pickup, so that way they could throw up over the side. but you know they didn't want people getting stuck down there or anything, so you give them a call and they'd come down and get you.
So anyway, moving on a little bit from Fort Polk, you end up at Camp Casey. Is it, how do you pronounce it?
Casey
in South Korea.
Yeah. So there's a lot of stuff in between there. So
okay.
While I was at Fort Polk, you couldn't put in a request for a personnel action until you've been somewhere for 6 months. So at my exact 6 month point, I put in to go back to language school for intermediate Russian. It was so funny when the paperwork came back down, it had gotten disapproved. Everybody from my platoon level all the way up to Department of the Army, and somebody at Department of the Army said, no, we're gonna approve this, and approved it. So it came rolling back downhill, and of course now I have all these levels of command that are just mad at me. You know, not my fault. I didn't approve it. I just asked. So I got to go back to language school in Monterey for another year. And while I was there, I applied for active duty ROTC scholarship. So I got accepted for that. So halfway through a year of goofing off in Monterey, California, I get orders to go to ROTC and came to the university and did that for 3 years.
The University of Oregon?
Yep.
And what did you study while you were here?
Russian,
okay.
Because I was walking out of a Russian program into it. It was really funny. So a couple funny things about it. So I show up, and at that time we actually did paper registration. You walked around and you got cards and paper registration in MacArthur Court. So every department was there with their book, and you'd sign up. And so I went, and the registrar had evaluated my military transcripts and gave me credit through third year Russian. Well, to get a major in Russian, that's all you needed was through third year. You didn't even need to take fourth year. And but I said, well, I'll take a class, right? So I went to try and sign up for fourth year Russian. Well, no, we have a policy against that. You can't do that. I said, well, no, the registrar already gave me credit. You know, I don't want to retake third year. I already got credit for it. Well, you can get an exception if you go talk to the department head, which was Dr. Leon at the time. And so I went to Dr. Leon's office and introduced myself, and we sat down, and we talked for about an hour in Russian. And he said, yeah, sure, whatever, signed off. He said, you're going to be bored out of your mind. Because I was just walking out of a full immersion program.
Right, and does the DLI have culture and history and all that, or is it strictly language?
It's strictly language, and it's a very different language, too. So, yeah, you mentioned the culture aspect, culture and history aspect. It was really interesting. The people that were in my 400-level class, that was right at the time when the wall was starting to crumble. Mm-hmm. You can see the thing. And I knew all the political jargon in Russian, and obviously the military jargon in Russian. You know, they could talk about how beautiful the flowers were. I could talk about the tanks rolling through the street. You know, it was a very interesting dynamic in the way people think when you learn a language, you learn a language. No, you learn aspects of the language depending on what you need. And I have a friend who does, who's still in the business, still a Russian translator, but what he's ended up specializing in is medical equipment. And it's very, very specialized. I mean, even in English, it's very specialized terminology. But, you know, once he learned that particular industry, he's set for life because there's so few people who do it.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it was interesting to look at the way we had both the university students and the military had learned Russian.
What was it like being a vet on campus at that time? And what year was it?
So this would have been, I graduated in 91, so this would have been 88 I started. There are really no incidents on campus. It was very kind of neutral period of time, I thought. In retrospect, somebody had asked me about, well, why would you want to go to the University of Oregon? Because of our reputation. And my perception as a vet on campus and an ROTC student on campus was the U of O has a very, very small but very vocal radical element. And that leads to this huge reputation. Most people on campus don't care if you're an ROTC. Most people on campus don't care if you're a vet. I mean, they're busy with their own little lives. But you have this little, you know, whatever it is, 1% or 3% or whatever, that make an awful lot of noise, and it makes it feel like there's a much broader support for a particular view than there really is. The transition from uniform to coming to college was interesting. I almost lost my mind the very first day. A big lecture hall, and I'm sitting down. Guy next to me, he's like, hey man, you got a piece of paper I could borrow? I was like, it's the first day of class, man. You're not ready for class? You know, I was very, you showed up, this was your job, be ready. And he wasn't. And then he asked for a pencil. It's like, oh, why are you here? Why are you paying your money if this is the way you're showing up for day one? You know, you're not even pretending, you know? So it took a little while to get used to a little bit more laid back attitude. Yeah.
How did you apply? I mean, you already just like discussed it a little bit, but some of the things that you learned while you were in the Army, life skills, how did you apply those to being a student?
I think a lot of it was just there's a couple things. So being in the military is one aspect, and the other thing is being a non-trad. I came back
a what?
Non-traditional student.
Okay.
So I came back. I was older. The fact that my life experience happened to be in the military maybe helped, maybe not so much, just having the life experience, but you know, just the discipline to stay on task, you know, meet schedules, meet deadlines and stuff like that. So
okay. So then you end up at Camp Casey in Korea.
Yep.
How did you end up there, and what was your experience in Korea like?
So so as I was finishing up ROTC, there's a process where they decide which branch you're going back into. So I ended up in Medical Service Corps, which is basically kind of encompasses all of the hospital admin, medical admin stuff. So I went to school in San Antonio for officer basic course, and then I went to Camp Casey. The reason I applied for Medical Service Corps, there was two ways you could fly a helicopter. You could go into aviation, which is helicopter pilots, or you could be Medical Service Corps and fly medevac. So that was what I was really trying to do. I was just really trying to fly helicopters. So that was my fallback position. So got a Medical Service Corps, put in my packet for flight school and stuff, and although technically I wasn't too old at the time, the reality was I was too old. They weren't looking to train somebody who was already 28 years old. Mm-hmm. So didn't end up doing that, but did a year in Korea. I mean, it was just, Korea's a 12-month assignment, so a lot of people rotate through, and they just need bodies over there all the time. Had a much different experience than Germany, obviously, because I didn't speak Korean. I kind of did what some of the people in Germany did. I kind of bunkered down a little bit and stuff. And, you know, it's like, well, it's only 12 months. You know, I can get through this no matter how bad it is. So, but I ran an ambulance platoon, and I was the executive officer for a medical company and a main support battalion. So it was a good learning experience. You know, for a first job as an officer, it was a good place to learn.
Being an officer differ from your previous experience in the Army?
You know, it really wasn't as dramatically different as I kind of, you know, when I was enlisted, you kind of had this thing, oh yeah, you know, when you're an officer X and when you're an officer Y happens and stuff. It really isn't that much different. Especially, you know, maybe once you get to be battalion commander or somewhere vaguely up there. But a lieutenant, you know, As a non-commissioned officer, before I came to ROTC, I was used to supervising people and being in charge. So a lieutenant, okay, so I went from supervising 10 guys to supervising 30 guys. Really wasn't as dramatically different as, you know, I had this vision, you know, once upon a time. So
how different was OBC from basic and AIT?
So I didn't go through OBC. I'm sorry. I was thinking OCF. So OBC. Officer Basic Course. So I went to San Antonio to learn how to be a Medical Service Corps officer. Tremendously disappointing compared to basic training. So you have all these people who have varying levels of experience coming to Officer Basic Course to learn how to be an officer, but. We never went to a rifle range. We didn't do a lot of the hands-on stuff we had done through basic training. Now, granted, most of these people were never going to actually do anything hands-on anyway, but when you do officer basic course in San Antonio, there's this weird little twist that in you're coming in as a second lieutenant, brand new lieutenant. In my OBC class, I had first lieutenants and captains. Because doctors come in automatically as captains. Right. Nurses, depending on what their degree is, they're either coming as a lieutenant or a first lieutenant or a captain. Mm-hmm. So I had dentists, I had doctors, I had psychologists, I had everything. And because I had been enlisted so long, they did this little thing, okay, who was enlisted, how long? I ended up being the senior person for our platoon as far as enlisted time. So I had to take everybody out in the field and teach them how to march. So you got all these doctors and nurses and stuff. It's like, really, really, okay, let's try it again, people. Left foot is going to be first, okay? Can we, left, let's focus on that. So, and then take them down. They had a list of stuff that they were supposed to buy for their uniforms and took them down to the clothing sales store and had to make sure they all bought the stuff. And, you know, I thought privates were bad sometimes, but, you know, doctors, like, oh, I'm never going to wear that kind of hat. Look, doc, I don't care what you're going to do. What I'm telling you is you're going to buy that hat, okay? I don't care if you ever wear it in your life. It doesn't matter to me, but you're going to buy the hat. So that was kind of a fun experience.
So then you end up at Fort Drum in New York.
Yep.
And can you tell us a little about Fort Drum?
It's
a little bit isolated.
Yeah. So I got to tell you why I ended up at Fort Drum.
Needs of the Army?
No.
Oh.
No, actually, and that was the funny thing. So coming out of Korea, kind of the tradition is you have a pretty wide choice of assignments. I mean, you did a sucky assignment. So they try and throw you a bone and get you a decent assignment. So while I was at Officer Basic Course in San Antonio, I had met Yvette Jones, now Landrum. And she went to Fort Drum. And so I call up branch manager, say, hey, you know, I'm getting ready to rotate a couple months and stuff. What do you got open? And he was listing these just guard spots. Hey, you want to go to Hawaii? You want to do this? It's like, I want to go to Fort Drum. Big, long pause. He's like, what? I said, yeah, I want to go to Fort Drum. He's like, all right, is this a love thing? I said, yeah, it's a love thing. He said, all right, I'll work with you. And it was so funny because they had absolutely no vacancies in 10th Mountain for me to go into.
Wow, and this is early 90s.
Early 90s. It was. I was moving as 10th Mountain deployed to Hurricane Andrew relief.
Okay.
Yeah, so it was in that span where it was Hurricane Andrew, Somalia, Haiti, that whole thing. But they did have a spot at the medical activity, MEDAC, for a logistics officer. And so I tell the branch guy, I said, hey, I'll tell you what. Lieutenant Jones, who's holding down a spot in division, she ain't a division soldier. And it's funny, my wife has almost the same amount of enlisted time I did. We now obviously never crossed paths. But she was a lab tech. She was a blood drawer before. Yeah, so I said, why don't you move her to the MEDAC, free up this spot in division, and I'll go take spot in division, that's fine. I was like, oh, okay, yeah, we can make all that work. So he moves all the magic pieces and stuff. So I was supposed to go to the main support battalion to another medical company, pretty standard medical service corps job. And I get to Fort Drum and sign in, and I have pinpoint orders from the 10th replacement depot to 2nd Infantry Brigade. I'm like, whoa, this isn't, no, I'm supposed to go to the main support battalion, Lieutenant Jones moved there, I'm supposed to go there, this is how it's all supposed to work. No, things have changed, you're going to the infantry brigade. So I go and I sign in, and I'm doing all my walking around and processing stuff, and I get to the point where I have to go meet the brigade commander, right? So, you know, report into the person at the desk. Oh yeah, he's expecting you to knock on, report on in. So knock, go in and report. So it was Colonel 06 William Ward, Kip Ward. I walked in and I saluted him and stuff. And so Colonel Ward and I had actually met when I was in ROTC. So ROTC, sometimes you get to do cadet troop leadership time, CTLT. So I went to Alaska, because I had never been to Alaska, to an infantry battalion at Fort Wainwright. And,
oh, God.
And Colonel Ward was the battalion commander, right? And on my exit interview, me and the other cadet, we went in and he said, well, what'd you guys learn and everything? I said, well, sir, this is why I did this. I said, the way the Army's structured, there's very few gunfighters, which are the infantry guys and the artillery guys. There's very few gunfighters. And the rest of us all support you. I said, when I was enlisted, I was military intelligence, and I supported the gunfighters. I said, the reality is, when I get commissioned, I'm probably going to end up in combat support or combat service support. But by coming to your infantry battalion, I understand better how to support you. And he remembered me and saw my name on a board at 10th Mountain. Yeah, and told his S1, I want Landrum in mine. So I get there. They didn't have a spot for me either, but they made me the brigade motor officer, and I hadn't been there, I don't know, maybe a month, and we went wheels up to Somalia. And I was the motor officer for the Task Force Commando, so it was Interesting time. Crazy. Yeah, it's just one of those odd flukes. So
Somalia.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Real interesting experience. It was very early. It was the first part of the whole Somalia experience. So the Black Hawk Down saga, they were trying to catch a guy named Adid, General Adid. When we were in Somalia, General Adid actually came into our compound on a pretty regular basis. He knew our colonel.
Really?
Yeah, from the war college. He'd actually gone to our war college. So it was really odd later on to look at what was going on and stuff. But so our job there was to escort food from the port Mogadishu into the interior. And we had some run-ins with different stuff here and there. I was primarily in charge of keeping vehicles up and running, or having my guys keep vehicles up and running. So, didn't do a lot of patrols or anything with them, which was fine with me. let the guys that like to pull triggers to go do that crazy stuff. But it was a very, very interesting experience. We moved on to a Soviet Air Force base in Ballydogle. And the buildings, imagine this room if somebody went to every plug with a crowbar and pried the plug out and then stripped the wiring out, and you could see the wiring where it had gone. And they would take apart buildings for components, basically, so they could, you know, you can use wire for anything. There at times our convoys, people were trying to throw their kids out in front of our convoys because they could get paid. So that was a little challenging at times. But all in all, it was a good experience. Like I said, we weren't there during the hostility phase of it. When we were getting ready to leave, and we had moved back down to Mogadishu, and we were just getting ready to leave, there was some mortar fire and stuff that would come into the compound every now and then, but it wasn't like as bad as it got later on. So,
did you have any interaction with local Somalis while you were there?
I had some here and there and stuff. You know, anytime you'd stop somewhere, the kids would come up and they'd be wanting to some of your MREs or whatever, a bottle of water, this and that. Not a lot. I had an interesting interaction with some Kenyans. They sent us down, after we'd been there a few months, they sent us down to Mombasa, Kenya for 3 days at R&R. And I was talking with some of the locals down there and having a beverage or two. And they said, "Hey, did you notice anything weird about the task force in Somalia?" It's like, "I'm not sure what you're getting at." They said, "There's no African countries participating." Okay, if you say so. I hadn't really thought about it, but oh, okay. And they said, "You know why?" No idea. They said, "Because the Somalis have fought this same clan war for the last 1,000 years, and they're going to fight it for the next 1,000 years. There's no point of anybody trying to stop it." It's like, oh, interesting. Too bad our politicians don't know about that little fact. So, yeah. And you know, it's just a whole different world there. I mean, it's all clan warfare. It's all, you know, who has the biggest army and the most guns. And
it's too bad our politicians don't know that about, right. About Somalia or Iraq.
Yeah, exactly.
Any of our recent military
members. Yeah, expeditions. Yeah,
yeah. So, you were stationed abroad in Germany, South Korea, and Somalia. Mm-hmm. Was there anywhere else?
That was it.
Okay. Yeah. How, in your mind, what are the main differences in the way that people in those three countries react to American soldiers? Because obviously the situations in those countries are very different.
So, in Germany during the time I was there and stuff, I think it felt very neutral. Obviously, American culture is so predominant everywhere. You know that the Germans that were, you know, our age, you know, early 20s or whatever, they wanted to talk with us, and they wanted to know what new music we knew about and this and that. It felt very neutral at the time. South Korea is different. I think South Korea realizes the imminent danger that they live under because of North Korea's political situation. And they always seem to appreciate us. I never had any negative interactions at all with any of the South Koreans. They were very, very nice people. And like I said, I mean, they know that if it weren't for U.S. soldiers being there for the last 40 years, that something was going to happen, you know, whether it be catastrophic attack from the north or something dramatic would have happened. So Somalia was a little bit different only because it was a very short period that I was there. And like I said, I think, you know, if you look at the progression of the level of violence towards U.S. forces in Somalia, you can kind of see where maybe we wore our welcome thin, where when we went in and we escorted some food convoys, took care of that problem, that was okay. But then the longer we stayed, it was, you know, kind of the interference factor. And that's when I think that we started getting a lot of hostile interactions down there. But that was after I left, so.
Okay. So after Somalia, you went to the Brooke Army Medical Center.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do there?
So,
And what year was it
now? Let's see. This would have been 1995. I went through the officer advanced course in San Antonio. Pinned on my captain bars. And my wife went through the same course. Anyway, I got accepted to do an internship to be a comptroller, Medical Service Corps comptroller. So start dealing with finances. So they sent me to Brooke Army Medical. And I was supposed to just do an internship, kind of ride side saddle with the budget officer there. And still a good friend of mine, Bob Griffith. And as soon as I got there, and apparently somebody realized maybe I had something on the ball and could probably stand on my own two feet, they said, oh, you know that internship that was supposed to be a year? Yeah, really, we're going to move Bob now and you're the budget officer. So, you know, here I have a brand new, I mean, at that time, literally they had moved into a brand new building the year before. Spectacular tertiary care teaching hospital. And I'm the budget officer for it. It's like, really, really? I don't think this is a good idea, guys. But I was just so lucky. There was a whole group of civilians that I, Department of Army civilians that I supervised. You know, and they had a lot of historical knowledge. They were all tremendously competent people. And they were used to the military rotating in and out every couple of years, you know. And they knew they were going to have a different boss. And they just kind of kept things going. They taught you in a very polite, respectful way what you needed to know. And but it was a really good learning experience, but it was a little intimidating at times.
Were there any frictions between the DA civilians and the Army personnel?
DA civilian stands for what?
Department of Army civilians. So any their GS workers, which is
government service. So their federal paycheck.
Right.
Okay.
But they work for the Army. So Department of Army civilians or DACs. We didn't have a lot of conflict. It was very odd. So at that time, and I think it's changed. In fact, I know it's changed. At that time, there had to be somebody in uniform that was at every blame point. So they had the budget officer in uniform in case things went sideways money-wise. So then I reported up to the director of resource management, and he had budget and he had human resources. So there was a person in uniform there, so if something went sideways, they could. So that way, we kind of provided a little insulation for the civilians. Mm-hmm. But the flip side of that coin then is, you know, like my senior analyst, Gilbert, he'd been at BAMC for, I don't know how long at that point, 20 years maybe. There was no reason he could not have been the budget officer.
Right.
But because they had this artificial has to be in uniform, he couldn't move up. He was as high up as he was ever going to get. Mm-hmm. So some of the positions were a little bit strained because of that.
That's still a fairly high-level GS position.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He was
a 15.
Wow.
Yeah, he was a 15. So
one was, more level, and that's into the senior service.
Yeah, exactly. Move up to the SES. So, but like I said, all in all, they worked pretty well together. I think sometimes the Army people had a harder time. In fact, I know they did. Guys that spent a lot of time in the field.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we had there was a full-bird colonel who had spent his whole life in the field, basically, and he came to San Antonio for his retirement assignment, and so. Field units, you can use the F-bomb pretty regularly, about every other word if you want to, and no one's going to say anything. Well, when you're having a staff meeting with a bunch of civilians and the F-bombs coming out every other word, yeah, people tend to react. So he had a really hard time making that transition. So, but look, watching the looks on some of their faces and stuff in the staff meeting, they'd just be like, you know, shaking. So, yeah.
So you've kind of like you've mentioned it sporadically throughout the interview so far. Could we get the full story of how you and your wife got together, both being in the Army?
Sure. So she has a version and I have a version. So I'll kind of give you a mix of both. So the very first day when I got put in charge of teaching all these people how to march, I was up in front of the platoon and my wife was part of the platoon. So she remembers me from that exact day. All I remember from that day is this whole block of people, you know, that aren't doing what I need them to do. So I don't remember that. But we were at a training exercise as training as a guy, we were actually living in kind of these Quonset huts and stuff and pretending we were in the field. Anyway, so I just got to talking to her one day, and there was a guy talking to her, and it didn't look like she was appreciating him talking to her, you know, but he couldn't kind of get the hint. Mm-hmm. So I kind of shoved myself in the middle of it and ran him off, because I'm subtle that way, I guess. So we started talking and stuff, and then I convinced her that it wasn't a date. I convinced her it was not a date. No, there's just a bunch of us all going out together. We're going to go to the Japanese steakhouse, blah, blah, blah. So went out as a group for our first date to a Japanese steakhouse and stuff, and then it went from there. But, yeah, it was funny. And my wife's African-American. And because she knew we were going to have face challenges, obviously, being a mixed race couple. And so she put me through every test that she could possibly think of. So she was going to this church very regularly while we were in San Antonio that was entirely black congregation. And it's one of these places, you know, where they have to pass around the microphone to all the guests, right? So, would we have all our guests stand up so they can introduce them? And the whole place just turns and it's like, looking at me. It's like, yeah, what's he going to say? So, so she put me through a lot of little kind of challenges and stuff. And I guess I passed them all because we've been married almost 21 years now. So.
I don't know if you could really like, I don't know, I mean, you haven't really been married to someone who wasn't in this situation, but what is it like being married to someone who's also in the armed forces?
Actually, I did experience both sides of it. So my first wife was a civilian, and there was a lot of challenges in that situation, only because, you know, when the Army picks you up and moves you, you lose your job. The civilian loses their job, basically. We good?
I was just curious.
Yeah. So that was a real challenge. And my first wife, she had a degree and everything, and you know, she wanted a career. Well, if you're picking up every 2 or 3 years and relocating, it's really a challenge. So obviously, both being in uniform alleviates that, and the Army makes tremendous efforts to keep people together. I think that the technical requirement is within, you have to be stationed within 500 miles, technically. The farthest we were ever stationed apart was, she was stationed at Fort Detrick, Maryland, and I was working in D.C., so I drove about an hour into work every day. But, but then the flip side of that is, my wife had retirement orders in hand when the current iteration of Fun and Joy started. So when we were getting ready to invade Iraq, and they took her little retirement orders, tore them up, and said, oh, by the way, you're going. She was the director of logistics for the 47th Combat Support Hospital. So complicating just the fact that her being deployed, we had a 6-month-old at the time, and our oldest son was, I think it's probably 6 at the time. I had 3 kids at that time. Was it Dakota? Yeah, Dakota was the youngest. He was 6 months. Then I had Zachary and Cesar. So I had 3 boys at home. The youngest was 6 months. And it was when nobody knew if there was really going to be these, you know, chemical weapons or anything. And so they land in Kuwait, and they all dig foxholes. And you know, every 5 minutes the air raid sirens are going off, so they're getting in their protective gear and stuff. And so it was a little bit rough. It was real rough. But the trade-off for her getting deployed, even though she was supposed to be retiring, was they left me in the rear with the rear detachment commander to be the XO for the rear detachment commander. So that was kind of the trade-off. They let her come back after, I guess it was about just under 6 months, and retire. So it all worked out. And, but we were both ready to be out at that point. You know, we knew things were not going to get easier. They were just going to get harder. So she retired, and I was right behind her a couple months later. So
when you were working at Fort Detrick, are you... You were working at Fort Detrick, or your wife was working at
Fort Detrick? I worked at Detrick, and then I moved down to Washington, D.C.
So what were you doing at that time?
So at Fort Detrick, I was budget officer for the Medical Research and Materiel Command, which a ton of research money comes in and gets farmed out to different labs, research and development on everything from, you know, soldier equipment to chemical weapons. So it all gets funneled through there and then spread out to the various departments and stuff. So I was firmly tracked into resource management stuff at that point in time.
We were talking about DARPA earlier before we met you, the neat things that they're doing right now. Do you have any idea what the neatest thing that you would have funded would have been?
And by neatest, to clarify, we mean most deadly.
Most deadly, yeah. No, I don't, probably, because...
Greatest cumulative...
Because really, I didn't read the proposals and stuff. I mean, I got a line items. It's like, okay, you're going to ship, you know, $5 million over the next 3 years to X.
Okay.
So I didn't read proposals or anything like that. I will say that on Fort Detrick itself, which is one of the kind of chem bio hubs of the Army, there's a building that is completely filled with concrete. They poked a hole in the top of it and filled it with concrete. Don't know what's in it. Don't know what happened. It's just there. So, you know, it's that, and then the animals that they use for testing, they burn those every, I think it was Tuesdays at the time we were there. So you'd be out and doing your morning PT and you'd smell this funky smell. So...
Lovely.
Yeah, lovely.
Yeah.
And that's why you got into TRICARE.
Right. That's when I found an office job. Yeah, actually more of an office job.
So TRICARE, do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, not a lot to tell. I mean, other than the fact I happened to wear green clothes to work, it was as close to civilian employment as you could possibly get. I didn't stand formations, didn't do PT, showed up, did my job. So it was, at that point in time, they had four different sections of the United States managing a part of the TRICARE contract. So mainly what I focused on was if someone's spouse, for example, wanted to be seen at Walter Reed, you could sign up to be seen at Walter Reed, and you were enrolled there. If you did that and you wanted to go downtown and get something done, you had to get permission to do it. Otherwise, we wouldn't pay for it if you didn't go through your primary care doctor. So I did a lot of reconciling of that. You know, we'd get these things. Well, you know, my doctor said that I could, but he didn't put in the order. So I did a lot of reconciling of that, a lot of number crunching, huge data warehouses and stuff. And so, but yeah, at that point in time, I worked for an Air Force Lieutenant Colonel, and the commander of our area was a Navy captain. 06 captain, and so that was my big joint assignment. Got to work with all the services, which was really cool. A lot of really smart people working there.
And then it looks like your last station in the Army was the 62nd Medical at Fort Lewis, Washington.
Yep. Not much to tell, really. I mean, I kind of already told you about getting ready to retire and stuff. We were able to. You know, I've basically been trying to get to the West Coast my entire career, and, you know, it just happens to be on a retirement assignment. But they had a spot for my wife, and because they were going to move her, they said they'd figure out something for me. So I ended up there. And went to 62nd Brigade. I was the comptroller, was my title, so managed the money for the entire brigade. Real good assignment. Was able to do a lot, I think, in my mind, positive things. You know, proper resourcing, and was able to do a lot of upgrades. So the office furniture, for example, when I moved in, they said, "Oh, that's your desk over there." It's like, really? So it was an old metal desk that was literally propped up on one corner by a stack of books. It's like, really? And the phones, I didn't know they still had those. They were the rotary dial phones.
Oh, wow.
It's like, how do you get anything done, you know? So I was coming from, obviously, a very cushy assignment at TRICARE. So I was able to help them make some investments, you know, modernize some stuff and improve some things. And one of the big things I was able to do is, as they were getting ready to deploy, so you have your normal operating budget for what's supposed to happen that year. Obviously, anything huge like that, they come up with contingency money. So I was able to document what we were spending on contingency that we hadn't expected, so I was able to get all that reimbursed. The senior resource management person at Fort Lewis at the time, Colonel Angelo Sante, had actually graduated from the Syracuse MBA program that I was in. There's the Army Comptroller program is at Syracuse. So we were Syracuse buddies, and so I was able to work with him and get some stuff for our unit that I probably wouldn't have been. So.
When did you go to Syracuse?
Graduated in 99. Yeah, graduated in 99.
And how did you end up in that program?
So the Army, every year, all the officers, you know, you can apply for graduate school and Medical Service Corps. There's a couple different programs that the Medical Service Corps pretty much focus on. There's a Master's Healthcare Administration at University of Texas, Austin, or the MBA program at Syracuse, and a couple other smaller ones. But, you know, after my experience with applying for ROTC, you know, going active duty ROTC, green to gold, the story about green to gold that I've always heard, I don't know if the numbers bear this out, is that they always had more scholarships to give out than people would apply. And so my philosophy was, you know what, if I don't ask, they don't have to say no. You know, so every year I'd throw it in, and I was made the alternate list, and got a call out of the blue and said, "Hey, Dave, somebody dropped off. Do you want to go?" And I said, "Yeah, absolutely." And they gave me a choice of healthcare administration at Austin or go to Syracuse and get my MBA. And to my way of thinking, if I got an MBA and I chose to work in healthcare, I could do that. But with an MBA, I could do other things, and I wasn't locked into healthcare. So that was my whole thought process on that.
But. Yeah, how did you like graduate school, and how did you like Syracuse?
Syracuse was good. I mean, having been at Fort Drum, which is an hour and a half north, further north than Syracuse, the weather wasn't a big surprise or anything. I had some frustrations with the program. And I think probably everybody who goes through an MBA program anywhere, you know, it's very focused on small group work. And the way our program was structured, we came in summer. It was just the Army program, and it was 15 Army personnel and 15 Department Army civilians. So 15 uniforms, 15 civilians. So they kind of got us up to speed. We did economics. We did a couple other classes in the summer to kind of get up to speed. And then we just integrated with the regular MBA program for the academic year. And then the following summer, we had a few more classes to wrap up, and we were done. It's kind of an executive program. The way they structured it, though, your small group, you stayed with your small group that you were assigned for the entire academic year. Every class, you were with exactly, that was your group. So it made it easier to coordinate things because you knew who you needed to coordinate with. But the problem was if you had a challenge in your group, you dealt with that challenge for the entire period of time. I will say I had challenges, not because of lack of effort. I had one guy from Hong Kong, one lady from Poland, and one gentleman from Turkey. So you're dealing with language barrier, you're dealing with some cultural issues, and so it made it challenging. It was productive. I'm not sure I learned as much as I thought I would learn in an MBA program. But at the time, you know, by the time I got there, I'd been doing resource management for several years. So, you know, I'd been exposed to a lot of it. And I wasn't going to go to Wall Street and be a finance guy, you know. So there were parts of it that weren't terribly applicable, but it was good. I was glad I went, made some good friends there and stuff. And you know, the one thing about it is when I retired, obviously, it's been a huge door opener for me, you know. And if I can get my foot in the door and get a chance to prove that I can do the work, then I'm confident I can do it. So in that respect, it's been a huge help.
So you retired from the Army in what year?
04.
04?
Yep.
And then how did you find your way back to Eugene?
Back here?
Yeah.
As I was getting ready to retire, I started floating my application around and stuff. And I ended up working for a state agency in Salem. My wife was finishing up her student teaching at the time, so she was getting her teaching certificate. In Washington, so she stayed there, and I came down and lived for a week and that whole thing. But while I was doing that, working in Salem, I was looking around the area, just absolutely couldn't find a house to buy. It was really weird, just nothing even remotely close to what we were looking for. And so finally, after several months of that, my wife said, well, you know, you're probably going to want to eventually get back down to Eugene or Springfield, so why don't we go look down there? And we found a farm, and just... You know, we thought it was the greatest place in the world and bought it and stuff. So then I'm commuting from Eugene back up to Salem on a regular basis. And it was, our farm was outside of Coburg, and our kids were going to Coburg Elementary. And the mayor, Judy Volta, kind of knew a little bit about my background. And the city of Coburg, I don't know how far back you guys' history goes in the area, but they had some severe financial challenges, huge, basically kind of a meltdown. So they were just starting to come out of that, and Judy asked me if I'd be the finance director. So I came down and went to work for there. About 12 months into that, the level of stress trying to deal with the small city budget, it was killing me. I mean, I was working as hard as I could every single day, and there wasn't an answer I could find. You know, how you keep trying to solve that equation a different way. And finally, I told my wife, I said, look, you know, I didn't make it through 20 years in uniform to kill myself when I retire. And I got to just back off of this. And she agreed. And I applied at the Budget and Resource Planning Office at U of O. Got through the whole process. They called me up, said, oh, we got good news and bad news. Okay. Good news, you were our top candidate. Bad news is we're going to reorganize the office. We're not going to fill this position right now. Okay, lovely. So I actually was going to be a stay-at-home dad for my two middle kids to go through kindergarten. We had it all figured out. And like I said, we had a farm. So it wasn't like I didn't have other stuff to do. Got a call out of the blue. Budget Resource Planning said, hey, we're done. We want you to apply. So came, got a job here, and spent maybe a year there. Moved over to the provost's office for when Jim Beam was there. Did finance for him for a couple of years. And then... out of the blue, they asked me to go to the police department and see what I could do to help them out. So
the UOPD,
yeah.
Police department?
Yeah.
So DPS?
UOPD. Okay. Okay. It was DPS at the time.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's what I do now. I'm the director of admin over there. Everything that isn't involving a uniform is mine. Payroll,
okay.
Resources, and logistics, all that good stuff.
Okay. And so you've been doing that job for how long?
A little over 2 years.
Okay. And, okay, so your kids are how old now?
My oldest is 18 and will graduate high school in June. I have two in middle school, two boys. So the oldest three are boys, and then I have a daughter who's 8.
So,
yeah, don't do the math. It'll get depressing.
Oh, no. That's not what I was gonna ask. I was going to ask, after your experience in the military, how would you feel about your children pursuing a military?
Oh, I'd be 100% behind it. When I went down and signed the papers originally, you know, there was no thought of doing 20 years. I was going to do my four. I was going to use my money to go to college, you know, and I hopefully had figured out what I was going to do by that time. But, you know, I mean, my oldest son, unfortunately, he has some medical issues where he could not go into the service, but he wants to go into culinary arts. You know what? There isn't a day that an Army recruiter wouldn't just jump at you if you went in and said, I want to be a cook. Mm-hmm. You know, you learn how to cook for a lot of people. You learn basic kitchen procedure. You know, for on-the-job training, and yeah, granted, it's not a very prestigious job in the Army, but it's important. You know, it really is. So, you know, as opposed to paying money to go to LCC to the Culinary Arts Program or something else, I'd be perfectly for it. Any of them, you know, that wanted to do it. The other ones, I don't think it would probably help them career-wise, but it might help them maturity-wise and stuff. So I'd be completely okay with it. My wife may not. But...
So when you joined, you know, you said you never expected to be spend your, nope. your life as a career in the military.
Absolutely not.
Looking back on it, if you were going to talk to yourself at that age, mm-hmm. what would you tell him about what he has to look forward to?
Maybe that it was just going to be a lot of fun along the way. You know, I met a lot of great people along the way and stuff and learned a lot of great things, had a lot of great experiences. It's funny because when I retired, I don't know, I didn't get promoted to major. I got passed over a couple times, and I couldn't break the code. For one thing, the career field I was in was only, there was only 6 people in the entire Army that did what I did. So it was very hard to move up. So by federal law, when I hit 20 years as a captain, I had to leave. In retrospect, as disappointing as that was in a lot of ways, I don't know that I ever would have pulled the trigger to leave if it had been up to me. Because, I mean, it's so much camaraderie. It's so much belonging. So in a way, it worked out good. You know, kind of kicked me out when I needed to be kicked out. So, but, no, I had a great time along the way. It was tremendously interesting and exciting. And some of it sucked. A lot of it sucked. But
it does.
But it sucks for a lot of people. You know, one of the things is, if everybody sucks, you know, okay. You just kind of laugh it off and get through it, you know. It's not like they're picking on you specifically, you know. It's just what's going on, man. You just knuckle down and do the job.
Do you have any questions you want to jump in with?
Well, we kind of hit on them in the email.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, what surprised you the most out of your military service? Other than the not doing, or you didn't expect to do 20 years.
Right. I don't know. It's hard to say because I didn't go in with a lot of preconceived notions, I don't think. But, you know, the level of professionalism and how serious it really is. You know, even my first enlistment, I don't think I really kind of realized how serious what we were doing was. You know, it was a lot of fun. You had your buddies. You know, and then over time and stuff, you kind of realize how serious it really is, and you know, the level of professionalism and stuff. It's an amazing organization.
All right, what do you think would surprise someone on the outside, a civilian, the most about what you did in the military?
How much fun I had.
Okay.
Yeah, really. I mean, you know, you can look at some of these situations, and you know, like you're sitting in the 130 degrees in Somalia, and this fine red dust is on everything, but you're having fun. You know, it's you make your fun wherever you can find it and stuff, and the camaraderie and everything, I think, really contributes to that. But yeah, you know, like I said, I mean, there are times that, don't get me wrong, it sucked, but all in all, I had a lot of fun. All
right, and then at least the last one that I can think of for me. 50, 60 years from now,
mm-hmm.
someone's reading this, trying to do some research. What do you think they're going to find? Or what would you tell them, you know, to kind of help?
Help understand it?
Yeah.
So, you know, you ask what would I go back and tell myself back then. And I actually think I approached it with this kind of attitude. Is as I was going through it, I can honestly say I never really had this concrete plan. But I always made sure that I didn't burn any bridges that didn't absolutely have to be burned. So, you know, literally three years into my first 4-year stint, I was, not going to reenlist, not going to happen, blah, blah, blah. well, yeah, okay, that last 12 months, it started scratching it, and I never did anything, you know, I didn't get in trouble, no Article 15, which is non-judicial punishment, never did anything to prohibit me from reenlisting. And so that avenue was open for me. And, you know, along the way, I always made sure that, you know, do the best job you can where you're at, and hopefully that will set you up for wherever they choose to move you next. You know, I think maybe that's what I would go back is when I was at LCC and I thought I had to have this comprehensive plan. In retrospect, I didn't have to have a comprehensive plan. Life isn't a plan.
Right.
You just kind of work your way through it. And, you know, that ended up working out pretty well.
All right, man.
Looking back on your whole time in the service, what do you think personally you gained the most out of being in the Army? Aside from maybe things you gained through your career,
mm-hmm.
Like personally in terms of personal development, how do you think you grew the most?
I think leadership, confidence. It's funny because hanging around my friends, you know, I moved back to where I grew up and stuff, so I see a lot of my old friends and stuff. And anytime we're going to do something, it seems like everybody defaults for me making the decisions. And, you know, it's like, hey, Dave, what are we going to do? Well, you know what, guys, you can make decisions too. But everybody kind of defaults for me to do it. Confidence to approach things that maybe you really don't have a great idea how to do. But, you know, you just, you know, if you walk in, you apply some common sense and stuff, it's probably going to come out okay. And the fact, and one of my frustrations being in the civilian sector is in the Army, one of my colonels told me one time, 95% solution on time is infinitely better than 100% a day too late. And I feel a lot of times in my civilian career that we always just keep working for that 100% solution. Let's have another committee meeting. Let's talk about this again. Let's make a decision. We've got enough relevant data to make a decision and move. And it gets a little frustrating sometimes in that regard.
Right. Okay. Is there anything else that you'd like to say?
No, this has been a lot of fun.
It has been a very enjoyable time, that's for sure.